and welcome to another episode of the Family Gamers Podcast. This is episode 368.
Hello, everybody. We are super excited to be back in the studio recording another episode of the show. And I think, Anitra, this is the start of a beautiful thing and something a little bit different where we are no longer restricting our interviews to odd-numbered shows. That's right. 368 is even. I can do math, but we have such a special guest. We couldn't wait another episode. We have Ken Franklin on the show. Hello, sir.
Good evening. I feel incredibly special. Thank you for letting me be on your show and completely destroying your mathematical construct.
That's, you know what? It's okay. I was actually thinking about it earlier today, and I'm like, you know what? The odd number thing, I think we're done with that. So we're just going to have interviews when we want to have interviews. So there, nanny, nanny, boo, boo. No one can tell
breaking
us
breaking the pattern of
I know.
300 plus episodes.
Well,
crazy.
You know, it's a year of change, 2024.
But that's true.
One thing that has not changed is I'm still going to bring facts to everybody. Are you ready for a 368 related fact?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. All right. So this is kind of cool. So Studio 368 is a studio production company, creative community hub, content agency, and gallery located in the heart of New York City's growing East Tribeca Gallery District. The studio is described by many as a content playground. It is at 368 Broadway or 370 Broadway. I think it's both. But some cool facts about this. Some really impressive people have come out of Studio 368. Greta Gerwig.
Okay.
Smartly.
Yeah, she directed the Barbie
yes.
movie.
Yes. Golden Globe winner Lena Dunham.
Okay.
Okay.
The Safdie brothers. They've directed a bunch of movies. Probably the most well-known would be Uncut Gems, which was an Adam Sandler movie that came out a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Neistat brothers, Casey Neistat has like 13 million followers on YouTube.
Wow.
There's plenty more, but those are just some of the kind of top shelf names that have come from Studio 368. So that's pretty much my fact. I just thought it was a really cool place that's doing some really neat stuff. The studio focuses on creating opportunities for creators by doing business with media companies and brands who need things made. And yeah, I just thought it was really, really cool. You can go to 368.nyc if you want to learn more.
All right.
And that is my fact.
And now a message from our sponsor. Before we get into the rest of the show, we just did our taxes this weekend.
Yay.
It was so much fun. But one thing it did do is it reminded me of something we talked about a while ago. Some states offer a tax break for residents who invest in their own state's 529 college savings plan. That has definitely worked for us. In Massachusetts, where we live, we actually got a tax deduction for using our state plans. If you want help planning for your kids' college education, you can go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers. There's a link there to set up a 15-minute call to see if First Move can help you.
Thanks so much to First Move for sponsoring another episode of the show. All right, we are at that part of the show where we talk about some games that we've been playing. We've got some weird stuff, interesting new stuff on my list for this week.
Yep.
But Ken, you are our guest. I would love to hear what you've been playing first.
Well, it just so happens that 6 minutes ago, I and my bride and two of our friends just lost a game of Daybreak by Matt Leacock and Matteo Menapace. That's a cooperative game where you're trying to reverse global warming. And we succeeded in reversing it in the sixth round. But unfortunately, we had to survive the crises. And when we revealed the crises, the world's crops failed. And we were overrun by rioters and lost the game. But
were
this close. Our success rate in this game is...
That's the best kind of cooperative game.
Yeah, 1 out of 3. I like to call it terraforming Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a huge stack of cards and lots of tasty, tasty choices. And at the very start, it looks like there's no way we can make this work. And then you, maybe. Not quite. But we came very close.
I think that tension is always a great thing, right? And of course, in a cooperative game, you don't want it to be too easy because then the challenge doesn't really feel like it's worth it. So I think 1 out of 3... I don't know, you're more of a board game designer than I am. What's the target win rate for a cooperative, you know, medium weight board game?
When Chris Lehner and Kevin Rogers and I made Back to the Future Dice Through Time, we were shooting for a 50 to 60% win rate. And I think we hit that. We're probably in that same zone with another cooperative game that we will discuss later this episode.
Burying the lead. Well, and if you're one of three, then if you win the next one, you're 2 of 4, which is 50-50. So right. There you go.
And we came very close. I mean, we did manage to become carbon neutral by the last round of the game. But both times we lost, it was because we hadn't also created enough resiliency to survive the crises that were going on. Mm. And so the world population lynched us even though we were successful.
Thanks, guys.
Whoops.
All right, Anitra, what have you been playing?
Well, I've been getting in a few more plays of First in Flight. The review for that should be coming out, I think, the same week as this podcast. Hopefully. I have not written it yet, but hopefully by the time podcast comes out, I will have.
Tasty, tasty game.
First in Flight is really interesting. It's going to be kind of hard to write the review for because there are a lot of things that I don't like about how the game works, but they feel incredibly natural and fit with the theme of trying to make a heavier-than-air flying machine, iterating over your design, continually failing and not doing as well as you want, and just trying to get a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better, while also trying to, you know, race everybody else to this goal of heavier-than-air flight. So there are some things I don't like in how that iteration works itself out, but it makes sense with the way the game is put together.
It has a bit of a runaway problem, I think, but
yes,
but it is fun. I do love me some pusher luck games. So
it's a different take on a deck building game. And that part I can really appreciate. Mm.
I mean, it has that Artana quality, right? Like it's a very well put together, well designed game. It looks nice on the table. It has a lot of that really nice presence to it. But I agree with you. The one time that I did play, there were some weird things in the mechanics. So maybe we'll get it to the table one more time before the reviews.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do. Mm-hmm. How about you, Andrew?
We were talking about pusher luck games. I guess I'll talk about another weird pusher luck game. And this is Explosion in the Laboratory. You and I played this last night. It's published by Weird Giraffe Games, just like Fire in the Library. This is a game that was designed by Corey Andalora. It's a 27-card micro game that deals with mixing vials in a progressively more dangerous way, where you can't have too many of these unstable mixtures, or there will be an explosion, or depending on how you unfortunately press your luck, you might just get an explosion. Pretty much not quite right away, but almost right away. I mean, this is the kind of game where the risks are high from the very beginning
and then they get higher.
yeah, for sure. It's not impossible to go a couple of rounds without scoring any points, which can be a little bit frustrating, but there's something unique about the mechanics of this game and about how you calculate things, because it's push your luck, but with no dice. And it's not like you're dealing out a deck until you get a bad card, which is how First in Flight works, because it's a push your luck deck builder. So it's interesting mechanically. It's a game that I definitely want to play a bit more of before we review it, right? I'm really curious how it's going to work with the kids, because I know they do get a bit frustrated with some things sometimes. So we're just going to have to find it out when we find out.
Well, and as luck heavy as it is, it felt not unfair at two players, but it felt kind of like really frustrating. Like if you're way behind and it's two players, you just kind of like throw up your hands. You're like, ugh, this is never going to work. I have to push my luck as hard as possible or I'm just guaranteed to lose.
Right.
And I generally don't feel that way in a push your luck game with more people. Mm-hmm. Something about the way you can compare yourself to other people, it just doesn't feel as hopeless if you're not in the lead. So I'm wondering if that will also carry through playing Explosion in the Laboratory with three or four players.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, the more people you're playing with, the easier it is to remember that you're playing a game for the sake of playing the game, right? You're playing to have a good time, to spend time with your friends. I mean, you and I play a lot of two-player games, and we play to have a good time and spend time with our friends. But it's easier when there's more people, right? Because
if
some person is just running away with it, then everybody else can kind of wallow in your own miserable joy together.
Or you fight for second place or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think the game dynamics will change a bit with more players, as long as they're not crying because they keep exploding.
Yeah, that's going to be something to watch out for.
All right. What else have you been playing, Ken?
Well, the other game I've been playing is a much lighter game, but no less tasty. It's Tir-na-n'og from Grand Gamers Guild by Isaac Shalev and Jacob Slingerland. It is a tableau builder where you have a varying set of three criteria that you're trying to build these. The conceit of the theme is you send your storytellers into the Irish Celtic fairyland to look at experiences, and then you come back and take some of those experiences and turn them into a saga. Well, what that really means is you go claim cards and you take those cards and you try to arrange them. So you're trying to make clumps of colors, and you're also trying to satisfy all three competing requirements of the rows of the game in a tableau of 3x5 cards. It really could be any theme, but playing it in the Irish Celtic theme, I think, is very beautiful. The art is very evocative, but it's very easy to pick up, and I've played 5-player games that took 35 minutes. So it's nice to get through and have fun. And the scores come out pretty close. So I've played that 4 times already and enjoyed it every time.
Nice.
Is the split drafting in that, where you put the characters between the cards?
For instance, in a 4-player game, you would have a 3x5 layout, and you put your storyteller on the bridge between two adjacent cards, and starting with the player and going clockwise until all the storytellers are placed. And then going counterclockwise from the last player going around, you pick up one of the storytellers and one of the cards that they were touching. So you may be first to claim cards, but you'll be the last to pick them back up. And there are reasonable times when both cards that you were touching are claimed, in which case your storyteller is so-called lost, and they get the leftovers. They get some of the leftovers. And I'm a real fan of the snake draft, where you go one way to start the claim and then back the other way to finish things off. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it leads to very close games.
Yeah.
Tir-na-n'og is a fun fact. The first ever published game that I actually got to talk to people about the design while they were designing it.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Grand Gamers Guild. Mark and Anish and I have all become very good friends. And I got to hang with Mark while he was discussing the design of this game back at Gamma in 2022. So I've played some old versions of this one.
Would your podcast like an exclusive scoop?
Oh, absolutely. We would always like exclusive scoops.
Sure.
Grand Gamers Guild also carries a series of 18-card games called Holiday Hijinks that are little mini escape rooms. Well, they are branching out into a set of 18-card escape rooms based on the themes of their games. And the first one that will be released is Tir-na-n'og, designed by Ken Franklin.
There you go.
Fantastic.
I fell in love with the game, and so I put myself in the challenge of trying to make one of these, and then I blind pitched it to Jonathan Chafer and Mark Spector, and they signed me. And so now I'm going to be making games with their game Roll Camera, and the Artemis Odyssey will be coming up soon as escape rooms and those game themes.
Nice. That's very cool.
Yeah, I will say there are some other holiday hijinks related things coming. I was at Gamma 2 weeks ago, and I spent the whole week with Mark, so we talked a lot.
Yeah, he's got a team doing all of the Endangered games.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. The first one of those was Kickstarted along with the Red Wolf, the American Red Wolf expansion? I think it was.
Maybe.
Yeah. But yeah, we also Kickstarted Tir-na-n'og. We have our copy. I don't even think we've opened it yet.
No, we have not.
Just crazy busy.
Someday we'll find the time to play it.
It's a great game. Tir-na-n'og, one of very few games that I have played in multiple countries, because we played it at Essen. So,
right. Cool.
Yeah, long history with that game.
And yet, I've never played it.
Yeah,
I would
right?
like to
I know,
at some
I know,
point.
Terrible, terrible.
It's a good 2-player game.
Mm-hmm. Noted.
All right.
I think I know what we're doing later this week.
You know it.
In the meantime, I'm going to talk about a light party-ish kind of game that we played with the whole family. And that one is called Mind Map. So the way this game works makes me think a lot of a game like a Wavelength or something like that, where everybody is trying to sort of put a scale on things that people don't normally quantify. But Mind Map is a competitive game where everyone has a clue to give and everyone is trying to guess all the other players' clues.
Oh my goodness.
So in our case, with five players...
Honestly, it sounds complicated.
It sounds
the way
more complicated
explaining
than it is.
It is not complicated at all. It actually works very well.
You basically, as a group, you have a very rudimentary graph with an x-axis and a y-axis. And you have put random cards on those. So the x-axis might be good for the holidays. And the y-axis might be...
Noisy,
yeah. And then, in our case, there would be five cards, one for each of the number of players, just kind of lined up with numbers, 1 through 5. Those same numbers, 1 through 5, get passed out secretly to the five players. So then you have, okay, this is my word that I need to clue. And you put a big old marker down somewhere in the X and Y axis of, if I have maybe a sled, that's really good at the holidays, but it's not super noisy in and of itself. So high on one axis and low on the other one. But maybe Transformers.
Or... not good for the holidays. Very noisy.
Maybe good for both if you're a kid.
If they're the actual toys, they're great for the holidays.
One of the hilarious things that we had when we played was that our youngest was trying to clue us, and his quote-unquote secret word was spray paint, and he decided that spray paint was something that didn't need any instructions at all. And when that was revealed, the rest of the four of us looked at him and like, you've obviously never looked at a can of spray paint. The entire thing is an instruction manual.
So the things I really like about Mind Map, so everybody drops their clue on this XY axis, but one thing that's really, really helpful is that there's an extra card that's put in the playing field.
Pretty much right in the middle.
And the thing that's great about this card is it allows you to index whatever your thing is against that card. Because otherwise, people could be using whatever scale they want to, and nothing is relative, and it's impossible. So because there's a card out there that says, if you put it to the left of this, it means it's less of whatever's on the x-axis. If you put it to the right, it's more. You know what I mean? So it was a really, really smart way for the designers to put boundaries on what these kinds of estimates are going to look like.
That's a genius.
And honestly, yeah, it's brilliant. And it's a very, very simple thing that makes the game actually work. Whereas, because I bet you they in playtesting, they didn't do that. And they're like, oh, there's no way. Like, nobody would, you know what I mean? But all they have to do is use another one of the cards from the deck and just put it out there as a way to kind of index all of the relative scores against it.
Well, it means that immediately you kind of have four quadrants.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, well, I know that my thing belongs in this quadrant, and now I'm just trying to, you know, is it more or less within
Interesting
here?
Way to think about it. Like, even though you have this normal axis, you've kind of displaced the center to whatever that card is. That's kind of an interesting way to think about it. That's funny. Yeah. But no, great game. Honestly, it went over so much better than I expected. I thought this was going to be something that we tried to play with the kids, and you know, one of them enjoyed it, one of them was ready to be done, and the other one only played because we promised ice cream. But it seemed like everybody pretty much enjoyed themselves.
Good.
Yeah, so we'll definitely be playing more of that.
Mm-hmm. For sure. The last game that I played was a very simple game that I played at the Gamma Expo. We were hashtag hosted media at the Gamma Expo. Thank you to Gamma. I played it with the designer, and I knew that the boys would love it. It's a game called Tin Spin. This game, incredibly simple. It basically comes in an Altoid tin. And in the tin are a bunch of dice, polyhedral dice. There's a D20, there's a D12, D10, D8. I don't know if there's a D6 in there.
There are two D6s. There's one that's a normal D6.
There's a normal D6, but then there's this other D6 that kind of looks like a rocket ship kind of thing. Whatever.
Yeah.
And the entire gist of the game mechanically is on your turn, you can either choose to spin your die, In which case, everybody has to spin their dice or roll your die. And if you roll it, you have to get a one or a two or a three. And if you do, you get a gold cube. The first five gold cubes wins. If you choose to spin your die, everybody spins, and whichever one, whoever is the active player, if theirs is the last to stop spinning, they get two gold cubes. It doesn't matter for anybody else. Then you have to roll like a switch die, which says basically, you know, you don't have to switch your die out. You have to, everybody passes their dice to the left. You have to switch with one that's in the tin, whatever. And that's pretty much the whole game. And you just kind of go around until somebody gets to five cubes. You can gamble cubes. If you think you're going to get a one or a two, you can like bet two and then roll. And if you get it, you double. And if you don't, you lose those cubes. But it's super simple, very, very basic. Boys love it. Teenage preteen boys are just, I mean, we're spinning dice anyway, right? You're just kind of goofing around spinning them. Very simple game, very inexpensive, very portable. Tin Spin from, I think the company is Surprisingly Fun Games.
That's a good name.
And it was. Did you enjoy playing that, Anitra?
I did. I'm going to say two quick things about it. First of all, for a game that is so light and simple, it also has a surprisingly well-fitting choose the first player mechanism, which is that the tin itself has kind of like a tornado sort of print on it. And to choose the first player, you put the lid down on the tin and spin the whole tin, and whoever the tornado is closest to pointing at is the first player.
Brilliant.
This is the kind of game that, you know, you feel like was born out of necessity, right? They needed something to play and they grabbed whatever they had.
They just grabbed a bunch of dice and they're like, why do you keep trying to spin that die like a top? Maybe we should all try to do that.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I did find it really interesting that strategically, generally speaking, the dice that are the easiest to spin are the ones that you're the least likely to roll a one, two, or three on. So like there's a D4 in there. Nobody ever says, oh, I'm going to spin when they have the D4.
It's like impossible
Spin a D4. You can't spin it like a top. But you're like, oh, I have a 75% chance of being able to roll a one, two, or three. Nice. I'll just do that.
Have you seen the more oblong D4s? They're not the pyramid shape.
Yes.
They're the interlocking U shapes.
Yes.
I much prefer those D4s.
Something like that you could probably spin. Yeah.
They're also easier to pick up.
Yes, they
yes,
are.
Yes, that too.
And less likely to draw blood.
I call them D&D Caltrops.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reasonable name. Well, why don't we, at this point, we'll do our monthly report for February, and then we'll welcome our new members, take a break, have a snap review, and then we'll get back. We'll come back, and we will discuss our topic, which is that other game that Ken might have teased a little bit earlier. So, Anitra, how many games did you play in February?
Mm-hmm. In February, I played 30 games, a total of 48 times.
Oh. I didn't feel so bad when you said 30, and then I realized that you meant 30 unique games.
Don't worry. My March numbers are much worse. Your well, March numbers are much better.
In February, I played 14 games, a total of 20 times. However, I played Archaeologic 4 times and Unmatched 3 times. Picky Pixie twice, and everything else once. I played something approximating 65% of my games two-player, which means probably just with you.
Sure. And, over 50% of mine as well.
Yeah, and 85% of my games I played at home.
Okay. 79% of my games I played at home.
Mm-hmm. So,
What's your H index for February?
A stunning 2.
Okay.
Yeah, not very good.
I hit an H index of 3, and there were actually quite a few games I played 3 times. Mm-hmm. Archaeologic, as you mentioned, Redwood, Unmatched, At the Helm, and then two really fast ones, Skyrockets and Pocket Paragons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really have anything remarkable to say about February at this point.
It
I will
fine.
Say that I already have the same number of plays in March that I had in February.
I do not. Not even close.
All right.
So stay tuned. Next time, we'll probably be able to give you the March monthly report.
All right, Andrew, guess what? We have new members in the community.
We do. We should
lot
welcome them.
them. All right, I will get it started and say welcome to Julianne.
Welcome to Anthony.
Welcome to AB Jack.
Welcome to Patty.
Welcome to Caitlin.
Oh, hi, Caitlin. Welcome to Leanna.
Welcome to Roselle.
And Mike.
It's about time, Mike. Come on. Welcome to Allison.
And John D.
Welcome to Ken.
Not that Ken. Different
that
Ken.
Different Ken.
Welcome to John.
Welcome to Luca.
Welcome to Justin.
And welcome to Tarmolia.
Thank you all for joining us. We love having more people in the community.
And if you are already in the community, you should definitely head over to this lovely picture of Jennifer Aniston saying hello and welcome our new community members. All right, well, I think that is about it. We're going to take a quick break, and then you are going to listen to us talk about adorable little swimmers getting eaten by an adorable little shark.
It's Get Bit.
We'll be right back.
What are sharks' two most favorite words?
You're fishy?
Man overboard.
This is a snap review for Get Bit.
Get Bit is a game of swimming faster than your friends by Dave Chalker. It's suitable for ages 8 and up, and it plays in under 20 minutes. This new version from Greater Than Games and Flat River Games can be played by 2 to 7 players.
So let's talk about the art in Get Bit. In a game like this, the art isn't just in the cards, but in the industrial design as well. Gone are the Lego-style men of the original game, and all the pieces have received a wonderful touch-up and are made of this really soft, adorable plastic.
The theme has been tweaked to be about bath toys, and it's adorable. Look at this cute pink shark! It looks just like a little squirter toy. And there are 6 little swimmer toys as well. The cards are all bath-themed, too.
I love all of these illustrations because of the different colored swimmers just motoring along.
And just look at these happy shark cards and the little soap tokens.
These swimmers are really, really cute, but their arms and legs still pop off.
But that's by design. We'll talk about it in these mechanics. Every player chooses a swimmer and takes the matching deck of cards. Lay the swimmers out on the table in a line, but in a random order. Put the shark behind the last swimmer.
Every player chooses a card from their hand and then reveals them simultaneously. It's time to swim.
Any players whose cards match each other don't move this round. Then, starting from the lowest untied number, each player moves their swimmer to the head of the line.
Each player sets their played cards aside. In the first round, that's it. Go on to choose another card from your hand.
But starting in the second round, the last swimmer in line gets bit. The player removes either an arm or a leg, their choice, from their swimmer, and then moves them to the front of the line. They also get to pick up all their played cards.
When a swimmer loses their fourth limb, they are eliminated from the game.
When there are only 2 swimmers left, the shark devours the swimmer in the back of the line, no matter how many limbs they have left. The other player is the winner.
You need at least 4 swimmers for this game to work properly, so if you have fewer than 4 players, there's a few modifications in the rulebook. For 2 players, you each control 2 swimmers, but as soon as one is eliminated, the other player wins. With 3 players, the 4th swimmer will be controlled by random draws from the deck. So Anitra, what did we expect from Get Bit?
I first saw Get Bit over a decade ago now on the old tabletop show with Wil Wheaton. The group that played it had a blast running out in front of each other and trying not to lose limbs to the shark. The swimmers were really blocky and they looked kind of like robots. In fact, that's how Wil Wheaton described them. They're robot swimmers. I really love this new theme from the moment I saw it. Bath toys make the game a little bit more lighthearted. I also expected it would go over really well with our boys. There's something about losing limbs and being eaten by a shark, or getting your friends eaten by a shark, that's just right for them. But I was a little nervous about player elimination. It's no fun to sit and watch everyone else get to play a game after you've been kicked out.
I was also concerned about player elimination, since that's something that we always think about when we're playing family games. Like you said, it's just not fun to sit there and watch everyone else competing for glory.
But what surprised us in this game?
Well, how much more flexible this version of the game can be. The original only worked at 4, 5, or 6 players. This version can handle any number of players between 2 and 7.
One reason you can do a higher player count is because one player can be the shark. They get their own special deck that determines what limb they get to bite and sometimes penalizes swimmers in other ways. But if their card misses, they lose a hunger token, one of these little soap guys, instead of biting. The shark can lose by running out of hunger tokens, in which case the swimmer with the most limbs wins.
And then there's the surprise of how okay our kids were with elimination. Having to wait around and watch after being eliminated isn't really a problem in this game, both because the game's very fast. Once you're eliminated, it's pretty likely that the game's going to be over soon, but also because you want to watch and see what other players get eliminated too. Our kids were usually rooting for the parents to get eaten.
Of course.
Plus, they could play with these cute little guys while they were waiting.
Would we recommend Get Bit? Yes, I think we would, especially with preteens and teenagers. It's incredibly fast-moving, it has a great look to it with all these 3D figures that makes it really easy to understand, and who wouldn't want to rip the arms and legs off their little swimmer guy?
It's fun at two or three, but it's best at four or more players. But this is totally a game your kids can play with their friends as young as maybe eight or so, or do what we do and play it as a whole family with kids trying to outrun or outswim the adults.
It's fantastic.
We're going to rate Get Bit 4.5 limbs out of 5.
And that's Get Bit in a snap. And we're back. So we were discussing a little bit earlier that it's been a long time since we've actually had you on the show, Ken. It's wonderful to have you back, but we're not just asking you back because we like talking to you, although we do.
Thank you.
I will say, by the way, there are I could count on probably one hand the people that I'm the most excited to see when I go to conventions, and Ken is in fact on that list.
Well, thank you. That warms my heart.
I haven't seen you in a long time, because I don't think you were at Unplugged last year.
I did not make it because Calliope didn't make it, and I was busy back in clinical practice. I'm back seeing patients full-time, not full-time, but 10-hour days, 3 days a week. Had a family financial crisis that put me in debt for six figures, and I'm paying that off by going back to work. And wow. But it's a rewarding way to do it, taking care of people who otherwise wouldn't have an ability to get healthcare. But I will be definitely coming to Gen Con. It's up in the air whether I'll be at PAX Unplugged. I will have a Saturday day pass at Grand Con this year in Grand Rapids, where we've been asked to bring back a giant Mansky Caper. We'll be playing that on Saturday.
Ooh, fun.
Fun.
And instead of 4x6 room cards, it's 4x6 wall posters. And the safes are 12-inch cloth cubes, and the tokens you bring out are bar coasters. And the D12 danger die is the size of a softball. So.
Love it.
Fantastic.
I love it. Awesome. All right. Well, so episode 81, episode 200, episode 368. What, pray tell, other than your charming good looks and your scintillating personality, has brought you back to the Family Gamers Podcast?
I am proud to say that we being the groups of Chronoverse Labs, that's Chris Leader, Kevin Rogers, and myself, have designed a legacy cooperative game, Flashpoint Legacy of Flame. And it introduced on the 12th of March on Kickstarter, and at the time of this recording, has raised nearly $175,000.
Oh, more than that. It's almost at $180,000.
Very nice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, when this podcast is released, there will still be 3 days to go on the Kickstarter. So if you are hearing this and you are currently doing what I did when I saw there was a Flashpoint Legacy game and, you know, freaking out, you should probably head over to Kickstarter. But let's talk a little bit about this game. So the announcement that I saw was Rotto freaking out about this game. I mean, I feel like Flashpoint is one of those games that has really been beckoning a legacy version for a long time. I imagine you couldn't guess why it hasn't had one yet, but what was it that caused your team to say, we should do this thing?
Well, it had been talked about at Indie Boards and Cards for quite some time, and Tricia Sidney was working for them. But Aeon's End and some of the other games were getting more legacy and more campaign things, and so it was kind of pushed to the back burner. Plus, it was a bit more of a challenge trying to create a legacy campaign that fit the mold of Flashpoint. I mean, you can't go into the same burning building 12 times in a row. But Trisha is a very good friend, and she'd had some health concerns. And around the time of 2021, but around the time of PAX Unplugged, she called me to ask some medical questions at about 1 in the morning, which I had told her she could. And we answered those and took care of her, made her feel better. And we started talking about other things. And she said, you know, I sure wish somebody would make a legacy version of Flashpoint. And I said, I could make a legacy version of Flashpoint. And she said, you could? I said, give me a couple days. So the next morning, I called Chris and Kevin and said, do you want to make a legacy version of Flashpoint? And they said, are you kidding? Yes, of course. So we applied it with the same reckless abandon that we had applied to Back to the Future, and had the first third of the game mapped out within a week. And we set up a Zoom meeting with Nick Little and Travis Worthington and pitched it to them. And we explained how we could do this. And they said, okay, you're signed. And so they signed us to a contract. And we spent the next 3 years meeting on Zoom weekly, once face-to-face and then once on Tabletop Simulator. And we played the snot out of it. And we came up with something we're very proud of. I'm very blessed to have a collaborative relationship with Chris and Kevin. We each bring something different to the table. Kevin has a gift for narrative design and just talking about the flow of things. And he wrote essentially the screenplay of the campaign. Chris is an incredible rulebook editor and has a great eye for spotting what works and what doesn't work, what keeps the fun in the game and what drains it away. And I found that I was able to put my tabletop playground prototyping skills to work along with using spreadsheets to manage the different paths that the campaign could take. And so we worked together incredibly smoothly, and we had the first third of the game done in about 4 months. And we had pretty much the whole game done in 14 months. But we continued to refine it with feedback from Nick. And now we're where we're at.
That's, I think that glimpses into the creative process in general are always fascinating because they're different for everyone. They're different for every group.
Right.
So I just think that's really cool. One of the things that I think is really interesting about this game is that, I mean, yes, it's a Flashpoint game, which means it's an IP that we know and we love, but there's a ton of content in the Flashpoint universe already.
Right.
So, of course, that first question that many people would ask is, well, what if I already have all this expansion content for the base game? What can I do anything with that? How does that all work?
Well, I think most people who, like me, are completionists of the Flashpoint universe will know you can't play all of the expansions at the same time. Some of them just don't work with each other. And so we had a copy of every single piece, and we said, all right, what flows? What is a path for a group of cadet firefighters to face as they go through their careers? And so we introduced elements of some of the expansions throughout the game as rules modifications, but we also added some new concepts that aren't in the universe and found how pieces of those would work together. One example is under tragic events, they have the idea of the fire deck and the event deck, where each round you flip a card to see how bad the fire spreads, and over certain times, special events happen. Well, that pretty much replaces the hotspots that were part of the original game. And we found that a lot of people weren't really thrilled with hotspots. So we chose to remove those and make the fire deck and the event deck part of each episode. And what that freed us to do was to make each episode a story. We really feel like we've achieved a case here where this is a mini series, you know, like Chicago Fire or, you know, something like that, where you get to know the people, your fellow players, and they, you know, it's an ensemble that different mixes come in as you use each time, but you go through a longitudinal set of different and unique experiences.
Do you get to use the dog?
Spoilers.
Come on, Andrew.
Well, I mean, I figured I'd ask.
One of the things, though, that we like to highlight, though, is when you're done with this campaign, you also have 12 new maps that you can play with any of the old Flashpoint content, including the dog as a character. So once the campaign is done, any character that you've had from an old Flashpoint module can be played on any of these. And the characters that you've built can then go back and play on any of the old Flashpoint maps. So it becomes its own expansion and not just a one and done.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Which is awesome.
Very nice.
So I think you said there were 12 missions in the
ish.
Box. Did I read that somewhere? Did you say that? Ish.
Ish.
12-ish, roughly. Okay, cool. Awesome. And then each one takes 40 to 60 minutes is the estimate?
That's about right. We tried to hold ourselves to that because we think after an hour, it becomes more like a marathon rather than a sprint, and the fun tapers off fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm. That is a lot of content, even if you're just talking about just picking up Legacy of Flame on its own, and then, of course, having all those characters that you built, having all that extra expansion content. I mean, there's just a ton there. I am looking at the Kickstarter page right now. I mentioned when this show goes live, there will be 3 days left, although there probably will be late pledging and some of those things, as usual. Projected to fulfill January 2025, which is a little bit far out there, but it's less than a year away. We can look on the positive side, say it's less than a year away.
9 months is not that long.
It's not that bad. Beautiful things are made in 9 months.
Yes, they are.
But there are a lot of really cool, you know, potential enhancements in here too. First of all, I always love neoprene mats. But can you talk about, these are really cool, can you talk about these maps that are made up with these spiral-bound books?
Yeah. When you're trying to build a campaign game, if you're having to be in different terrain each episode, the weight of trying to put 12 boards, even 6 boards that are two-sided, in a box is prohibitive, and the cost of producing that many boards is prohibitive. So we thought of this before Gloomhaven Jaws of the Lion did. We took the board and split it in two and made 2 spiral-bound books. And so when you get to the first prologue, you open to the first thing that's prologue 1. You put those 2 spiral-bound books together, and you have a regular-size Flashpoint board. And then you just turn the page, and you're on to the next. And that's to try to discourage people from looking ahead.
That's a good way to combine keeping it really portable, making it easy to keep things in order, and also being able to discourage looking ahead. I've definitely played some non-legacy but campaign style games where the first time through everything is, you know, there in order in the box. And then as you've played through, now you're like, oh, if I want to reset this to start the campaign at the beginning again, I have to go back and look through the rules and be like, okay, so first there need to be this set of choices, and then this behind them, and then this behind them. And that's a pain.
Yeah.
So I really like the idea of the spiral bound book to make that sort of thing much easier.
And we've also made sure that the components are labeled and numbered so that they're easy to sort out. And they just this morning announced that there will be a recharge pack so that you can go back to number 1 if you want to go back and watch the miniseries again.
Do it with slightly different characters, making slightly different decisions.
Right, and the characters, you personalize, you give a name to each of your characters, put a face on them, with some diversity. And one of the techniques that's in here that Rado pointed out is when you play the original Flashpoint, if you get knocked down by fire, you just go back to the ambulance and come back in. We didn't think that was right. So we introduced the concept of carrying equipment in. And if you are knocked down, you lose the physical ability to carry as much equipment. And you can continue to play with that character, with their abilities. But if you want them to be able to fully participate down the road, you have to sit them out, which forces the team to use all of the characters in the squad and get to know each of them. And maybe make some surprising discoveries of something that might be a new favorite for you that you wouldn't have originally thought of.
So you've talked a little bit about discovering different characters. A lot of times, like I think of the Pandemic Legacy characters, most of them will start with maybe one asymmetric skill, but then pretty much the characters become what you make them. But when you use language like you discover things about the characters, it makes me really curious.
I'm glad you're curious.
Man, am I going to make it upstairs before I pledge for this game? I don't know if that's going to
I don't know if you are.
One of the things that I have to give Nick Little credit for, of the many things, he's been a tremendous support throughout this entire process, as have the entire crew at Indie Boards and Cards. But we created a lot of envelopes. And he made the brilliant decision that instead of having extra envelopes, a lot of the components are scratch-off. And so the instructions will say, scratch off the ones with this number on them, which, again, reduces the cost of the game by quite a bit. But it also makes it more of a discovery process. What's going to happen next? You actually have to, in a tactile way, participate in discovering that.
Yeah, I really like the scratch-off mechanic. That's something that I think is becoming a little bit more available. Makes a little bit of a mess, but that's okay.
Yeah. Think about the ways you would experience a longitudinal miniseries. We tried to be faithful to that style. So things you will discover are not only new places, but new relationships and new people and new ways to fight fire. And all of those are included in this campaign.
All right. So looking at the Kickstarter itself, I mentioned kind of jokingly that I don't think I'm going to be able to get out of my office without pledging for the game. I do want to talk about that a little bit. So the base game is $59 plus whatever shipping will end up being, which is dependent on all sorts of different things.
That's pretty reasonable for a legacy game.
I think it's very reasonable. Do you need anything beforehand to play the game at $60?
No.
Okay.
Prologue 1 is essentially the family version of Flashpoint.
Okay.
Awesome. Okay. Prologue 2 is the advanced version of Flashpoint with the introduction of the concept of fire and event decks. And then the rest flows from there. So you do not need any components from anything else Flashpoint in order to use it. Now, if you've got your cute little individually painted minis, by all means, bring them in.
So the reason why I do ask that is because you've got that base for $59, and then there's a step up at $89, which includes Flashpoint Fire Rescue, the original game. And then it goes up a little bit more, $129, a copy of Flashpoint Legacy of Flame, but a set of cardboard maps. So instead of those spiral-bound books, you've actually got, you know, full-on cardboard maps and neoprene player mats. I love the smell and the feel of neoprene. It's like a narcotic. And then
don't snort them. And then it gets, I recommend it against
don't,
that.
Yeah, don't, please, please don't. Please, no. Don't do that. It gets even bigger. There are opportunities to pick up a lot of those expansions that we've kind of talked about already. Tragic Events, Dangerous Water, Second Story, the Rescue Dog. Love the Rescue Dog. So that's $179, and then at $210, it's everything.
Right.
Everything.
All the things.
All the things. So that's a pretty good range, $60 to $210, and there's a whole grid in here of shipping costs and all that stuff. People can figure that stuff out on your own. But right. I am really excited for this game. I think Rado is one of those guys who gets pretty excited about stuff in general, but boy,
if you can watch his video and not immediately turn around and pledge, you, I don't even know if you have a board gaming soul. he really, really enjoyed it. And he was speaking from experience because he played the game. I just think it looks absolutely spectacular. And I'm excited to check it out as well.
I can tell you that the game is better quality than Rottohead. He had a fairly early prototype.
All right.
And we have gone through several iterations since then. And again, so very thankful. The folks at Indy allowed us to review and vet the developments as we went through to make sure we stayed loyal to the game without allowing us to go into prima donna mode. This is my design and it will be the way that I created it. That's not going to happen. It's been a very collaborative process. And Chris and Kevin and I have been delighted at practically every point as we see new things finished.
Awesome.
Well, I'm excited. I'm ready for it.
Well, I'm just very grateful that we got the chance to do it because I think it's going to provide a lot of people at a lot of skill levels from the light family gamer on up to the heavy gamer a fun experience. It is not a dumbed down game, but at the same token, it is a winnable game. And the statement on the front of the box is every choice does matter because who you become and who you befriend makes a difference for throughout the whole campaign.
Okay.
Well, once again, super glad, Ken, that we were able to get you on and talk about Legacy of Flame. Super excited, kind of in the abstract that it's coming out, but, you know, seeing the names behind it. Obviously, we're talking to you, but, you know, we're big fans of Chris as well, and of course, friends with him. You know, just really excited for your success in this. You guys have been making good stuff for a long time. So we have lots and lots of confidence with Flashpoint Legacy of Flame as well.
Thank you very much.
You know, I guess at this point in the show, Anitra, it is probably time to talk about where people can find us on the internet. All of us.
Yeah, well, let's start with, if you're interested in Flashpoint Legacy of Flame, as we mentioned, there's still a few days left in the Kickstarter. And the easiest way to find that, we'll put a link in the show notes, but probably the easiest way to find it is go to Kickstarter.com and search Flashpoint. I'm sure you'll find it.
Absolutely. I know because I've only searched for it 623 times in the first week of the campaign.
Exactly.
That's what bookmarks are for.
Plus or minus three.
Yeah. So, Ken, where can people find you online if they want to find you or Chris or the whole team?
Well, I am on Instagram and X as Ken Plays the Number 2 Grin. Of course, you can find me on my name on Facebook. And that's pretty much all the socials that I do. Or you can look at under Facebook for the Franklin Farms Game Nights, and you can see where we open our house to the community every other Saturday and play all the games from our collection.
Very cool.
Chris is at Leader 88 on X, and I don't know if he's on Instagram, but he's, of course, by Chris Leader on Facebook. Kevin Rogers, you can search by his name. It's RODGERS. And he is mostly on Facebook.
Yes, we are a big fan of his work, too, on Unmatched and the game Mass Transit.
Oh, yes.
Big fans.
Chris and Kevin really knocked it out of the park with Mass Transit. And I can tell you, they have another game that's looking for a publisher right now that will be a success when it finds a home.
All right. We'll keep our eyes peeled. In the meantime, Andrew, where can people go to find us on the internet?
Well, you can find us on all of the things. You can find us on Facebook, on X, on Threads, on Instagram, on TikTok, and on YouTube at Family Gamers AA for Andrew and Anitra. You can also head over to the Family Gamers community on Facebook. The easiest way to get there is thefamilygamers.com/community, or you can just search for the Family Gamers community on Facebook. Of course, you should be going to thefamilygamers.com to read all of the 600 plus reviews that we've got up there and to vote in our March Madness tabletop family game bracket thing.
Yeah, and when this podcast comes out, we will be down to the final four.
The final four. My goodness.
I'll head over there right after this.
It only takes like 2 minutes. It's actually a very, very quick and easy thing to do. So vote early and vote often.
Yes.
Of course, you can join the family tabletop community on Discord. You can go to thefamilygamers.com/Discord.
We've got lots of great creators in there. Obviously, we're in there. One Board Family, JP from Little Big Thumbs, Brains on Games, and a few other folks are in there. It's just a great place to go to talk about family games and really to share across some of the various, you know, little communities that are related to the family-focused part of this hobby we live so much.
Yeah, including things like sharing some of our wins in playing games with our kids, whether that's, you know, hey, my kid finally beat me, or, you know, I convinced my kid who's normally kind of resistant to play this new game and they liked it, they want to play again. Sometimes, especially as parents, you want somebody else to just be like, I understand what it's like to deal with these hurdles in wanting to play games with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
However, you can also talk with us more directly and privately if you want by emailing us. I am anitra@thefamilygamers.com.
And I am very unoriginally andrew@thefamilygamers.com.
And if you want to complain about anything that I've ever done, you can get me at drkenfp for Dr. Ken Family Practice at mac.com.
Don't forget to check out our Family Gamers and Play Games with Your Kids merchandise, t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, and more at thefamilygamers.com/merch. Please don't forget to subscribe to this show. Tell all of your friends about this show, whether they want to hear about it or not. You should tell them anyway.
You might be surprised.
Leave us a review at Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Amazon Music, TuneIn, and Spotify, in addition to wherever you found this.
Go to thefamilygamers.com, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Last but certainly not least, The Family Gamers is sponsored by First Move Financial. Go to firstmovefinancial.com/familygamers and learn how the team at First Move Financial can help you pile up the victory points in real life.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much to the team over at First Move Financial for sponsoring another episode of the show. All right. Well, Ken, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Legacy of Flame. I think I've said about a billion times that I'm super excited for this. That has not changed yet.
Well, I'm very grateful that you allow me to come talk about it. And it is always a joy to see you and speak with both of you. I look forward to giving you both a warm embrace when we get to Indianapolis.
All right. So everybody should head over to that Kickstarter and take a look as soon as you hear this to make sure you can get in on the fun.
Definitely.
And until next time, everybody,
play games with your kids.
Exactly.